Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Renowned Podcast. We're your co-hosts, Allison
and Mark.
And Renowned is a podcast for the curious. We dust off the commonplace to look for shiny new relevance as we challenge ourselves to think critically about the objects that surround us. How do they echo humanity's past, reflect the present, or foreshadow the future? So, Mark,
or if they just piss us off. Some of
Which
our
is
episodes.
Sometimes the case for anyone who's really heard. I think it was Highway for me that almost did me in. So, Mark, what's our word this week?
So, our word this week is jewel. J-E-W-E-L, right? Jewel. I think it's interesting. Just to remind us, I know we're going to revisit it, right, audience, at the end of the episode. But for this particular one, Allison rated this 7 when we first got it last week, and I rated it an 8. So we're close and pretty high. I think we both came into this optimistic about what we'd find. So
we like shiny things.
I know, right? Cool. Do you want to roll? Yeah.
All right.
Let's jump in. One.
Four.
Nice. We didn't tie. It's like 3 weeks in a row or something.
I know bizarre. That we just kept.
All right. So let me give you some 15 seconds on the clock for your Just the Hits recap or foreshadowing.
I didn't say this out loud with a timer earlier, so I actually don't know if it's short enough. No worries.
And 15 on the clock. And go.
Jewels and gems have captured the human imagination since the Paleolithic, and that hold on us remains today, which leads to some amazingly bad attempts to procure them. Da-dun, 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 da-dun.
Even with the song, my ringer, even with the song that was perfectly 15 seconds.
Excellent. Okay, Mark, 15 seconds on the clock for you.
Perfect.
In 3, 2, 1.
Jewel has evolved from something of treasured value to mean more specifically gemstones. And even these very worldly objects have been distorted into mythical objects.
That's excellent. You had 3 seconds left. Ooh, I'm excited. Ooh. That sounds very interesting.
Cool.
All right. So I will jump down the rabbit hole. I didn't have All a right. nice punny. I didn't have a nice punny, you know, synonym down, for rabbit hole with this one.
Down the
muddy, unethical mine.
Gem vein. I don't know. It's not really a vein. It's not like gold. I don't know.
Okay. We'll stop now. We're really going down the rabbit hole. Okay. So you were nodding. I saw Mark when I mentioned like, since the Paleolithic, we've had this obsession with gemstones. So we know from the archaeological record that gems have been prized by humans since then. The Paleolithic it spanned from about 2.5 million years ago to about 10,000 BCE. And even that long ago, people were like adorning tools with polished ivory, for instance, right? So not just adorning themselves, adorning things. And they've actually done studies to try to figure out why we as human beings are so attracted to gems.
I'm so excited you went this way, by the way, because I feel like very often in our past episodes, I've like tread into this like area and I didn't this time. So it's kind of perfect.
Oh, perfect. I'm still waiting for that day that we both like have the same exact thing. So the best guess that scientists have right now is that the reason we're attracted to gemstones is actually evolutionary psychology at work tied to our survival instinct. So shiny things apparently make us think of water, which is our key to life. Oh. And so a couple of the studies are kind of interesting. So in one, participants are blindfolded and then they are asked to touch different landscape paintings. Can't see them. They haven't seen them beforehand. And they're asked to touch them. And then just to guess, I don't know if they brand it as maybe an ESP study, right? Kind of, but how much water is in the landscape that they're touching. And with a higher gloss, people guess higher amounts of water. So they're kind of saying, okay, there could be a corollary. And then in another study, participants are split into three groups and one receives salty crackers that they have to eat. One receives nothing. And then one receives salty crackers with water. And then they're asked to view glossy objects and kind of talk about how they respond to them. And the thirstier the participant was, the more likely that they preferred glossy things. So these are just some studies where they're trying to kind of tie it to this and that we have just this innate attraction to it. from a survival perspective, survival aspect. And of course, as the currency, and I know, Mark, a few episodes ago, you mentioned currency, and then you were just kind of opining like, that'd be a really interesting word to go down the history of currency and what we use and why we use it. But as an item of value, they're incredibly durable and relatively rare, both of which I think, I didn't read studies about this, but that plays into the obsession secondarily, of course. But this obsession with jewels has led to a lot of bloodshed. So the mining of gems is often done under, I go down humans. This path.
We're really good at that whole really good peace at, like, thing.
Just one thing, bloodshed. So, you know, a lot of times the wealth, like the mining itself is done under terrible conditions and the wealth doesn't stay in the countries of origin usually, right? And in the mines are also destroying important ecosystems and watersheds. And a lot of times the mine gems are funding war. It's not just that, you know, indigent folks are being forced to work in these mines and that's horrible enough in the environmental impact, but the money actually goes into funding war. So a prominent example, there's something called Palin sapphires that came from Cambodia and they were really highly prized. And the Khmer Rouge actually mined and sold those sapphires and used their ill-gotten gains to fund their offensive and then their eventual government. And that was a genocide where 1.5 million people were killed.
But that's the reason why things are called blood diamonds. Is that true?
That's exactly right. Okay. So blood diamonds are, specific to diamonds, like blood gems. I was reading an article that said there should be a movie called Blood Gems because it's really bigger than that. Current day, and the Myanmar military, they use gains from gem mining to fund their exploits, including the ethnic cleansing that's still going on in Rohingya. So those are just a couple of examples. It's my PSA time here. Just if you're in the market for gems, please try to do your research to make sure you're buying conflict-free gems, which is possible. And there are different certifications.
I'm going to mention a company later on.
Oh, good. Oh, excellent. So that's going to be perfect. And I know that usually I think I tend to take a social justice aspect on this. So, I'm going to now step away from the exploitation and talk about some other things, all which aren't necessarily good. But so we're all aware that extravagant gems are often also then, once somebody has them in their hot little hands, are often taken by force. And a prominent example of this is the Koh Noor diamond from India. There was a lot of public outcry after the death of Queen Elizabeth recently for the royal family to return all of the jewels that they've gotten through colonization. The Koh Noor diamond is just one of those, but no dice, of course. John Oliver on his show, on his HBO show Last Week Tonight, did a very funny bit on it. It's an older bit, but it's on the Koh Noor diamond and how India is saying, we'd like it back, please. And Britain's saying, no, thank you. We'll keep it. But it's very funny. And I'll provide the link. And I really highly recommend that you watch it. So the Koh Noor diamond's exact origins are a bit hazy, as are the origins of most, the provenance of most massive gems. But it's believed to have been mined in southern India in the 13th century. And the British came into possession of it when the East India Company took the jewel from a deposed 10-year-old, basically, but I'll go into a little bit of that history in 1849. It's currently set in a crown that was created for Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. Queen Elizabeth has also worn it, and it's reported that Camilla will be wearing it at Charles's coronation. So it is a crown jewel that is out in circulation. A little history on this diamond. India was the world, I found this so interesting. It was the world's only source of diamonds until 1725. Who knew? But then mines were discovered in Brazil. And of course, they've now been discovered on all sorts of places. The first time the Koh Noor is mentioned in writing is 1628, and it was in the possession, the Mughals reigned over India at that time, and it was in the possession of that leader, and it was set atop this bejeweled peacock throne, it was called. And then in 1739, Iran invaded India. So Nader Shah, who was the leader of Iran, invaded India, and he made off with a lot of gold and a lot of gemstones, including this diamond. It traded hands multiple times, like bloody encounter over bloody encounter. This diamond just kept changing hands. And then early in the 19th century, as I mentioned, the East India Trading Company greatly expanded their territory in India. And shortly after that, the Koh Noor diamond made its way back to India, and it came into the hands of the Sikh ruler Ranjit Singh. This was in 1813. So Singh dies about 25 years later, a little more. And then there was this really tumultuous period, and there were four different rulers over the next four years, just constant tumult. And when this all ends, it was a very violent time. And when all this violence ends, there are only two people left in line for the throne. And it was a young boy, the 10-year-old I mentioned, named Duleep Singh, and his mother, Rani Jindan. And in 1849, the British imprisoned Jindan, who was the mother, and forced Duleep, who was 10 years old, to sign a legal document amending the Treaty of Lahore, and it required him to give away the diamond and all claim to sovereignty. So that is, I know, it's just horrible. So that is how the British royal family got their hot little hands on the Koh i Noor diamond. There are many more examples, right, from countries all around the world of leaders and royals going ahead and taking this. But there is still in the media kind of an outcry for, especially now with Queen Elizabeth passing, for the royal family in Britain to give back their ill-gotten gems, but we'll see how that plays out. So with all these many examples that exist of ill-gotten gems by royals and rulers over the centuries, it will come as no surprise that I enjoy a story or two about this loot getting stolen again from despots. And this is not, I'm not condoning violence. So in the cases where there's violence involved, I'm not happy about it. But what I thought I would do, so that I didn't stick with this, like my usual kind of downer notes about the horrors of our nouns, is I gathered a few hilarious stories for you of jewel heists. So I'm going to share a couple of those. The first one is also about crown jewels, but French crown jewels. And Mark and I were in Paris recently, and we're in Versailles. And so this is very relevant since we were just there. So this happened in 1785. So Louis XV had an extravagant diamond necklace made for his primary mistress. In today's currency, it would have cost millions of dollars. I think they said something like $15 million. Might have that wrong. But he dies. It takes the jewelers an incredibly long time to gather like diamonds of this magnitude and then to make it. So he dies, about a year later, and the necklace isn't finished. So he dies without paying for it. So the jewelers are left on the hook for like millions and millions of dollars. And no one can buy this except royals. I mean, no one has the money. This is right before the French Revolution. And so the jewelers try to talk to Marie Antoinette about taking it. And she's not interested. And the reason was never recorded, but she's like, no, thanks. There's a legend that she said, like, we could use that. Or like, no, I need to use my money for like boats and soldiers and that sort of thing. But no one really knows if that's true. So then the jewelers go to her husband, Louis XVI, and they're like, hey, why don't you buy and give it to your wife as a gift? And he's like, no, thanks. So these jewelers, like no one will take this really, really insane necklace. The jewelers try to sell it to other royals of other European countries. And yeah. Nobody wants it.
My gosh, so it's then, like a sharp reminder. It's only valuable if there's demand.
Exactly. So then this weird thing happened. So this is, and this is true. I read a lot of sources to make sure because it is so bizarre, but it's well documented. So there was an aristocrat at the time named Cardinal de Rohan, and he was out of favor with the queen, and he really wanted to be back in favor with the queen and back in court and all of that. And so he was, trying all sorts of ways to get back in her favor. And there was a con woman, he didn't know she was a con woman, named Jeanne de Lamotte. And that, I think that was like her nom de guerre. I think like Saint-Rémy was her real name. She had convinced a number of aristocrats that she was very close with the queen. And she was doing this to get money from them, right? Because like convincing them she could have favors done for them and that sort of thing. And that's how she was making her money, she and her husband. And so this cardinal thinks, okay, she can help me because she's besties with the queen. And so she's all in, and she's like, she encouraged him to write to the queen, and then she would bring back her replies, and she brought back the replies, and the replies were so friendly and nice, but it was her husband or her boyfriend who wrote them. Obviously she didn't know the queen. So she convinces this dude, he's so desperate. He's fully convinced. And so she says, look, she wants to meet you. The queen actually wants to meet with you. And she arranges a meeting, but it's dark. It's at night. And it was actually just a prostitute who was paid to play the queen because she looked very much like the queen. And so he totally buys it and is like besotted and like, and he's so happy and he's so grateful. And so he would do anything, right? Like at this point to stay in good favor, what he thinks is good favor. So seizing her moment, Jeanne de Lamotte, she confided in this poor dude that the queen really wanted this like giant weird diamond necklace, but she'd already publicly been, it had already been documented that she'd said no to it. She didn't want word getting out that she'd actually pay that much money, such an appalling amount of money for jewelry when the country was in such dire straits. So the cardinal's like, got it. I'll help you. What's the plan? Like, she's like, well, would you go buy it on her behalf? Because that way it won't get out. She needs a middleman. He says yes. So he pays with aristocratic IOUs that were forged in the queen's handwriting. So basically saying, send me through my, emissary this necklace and I will pay you after I get it. And the jewelers are just like, oh my God, look, if there's a chance we can get this money, we're going to do it. This isn't fishy at all. And the cardinal's thrilled, right? Because he has this way to get back into Marie's good graces. So they hand over the necklace. The, you know, money was never paid. And the Jean broke down the necklace, sold the diamonds all over Europe, and they've never been recovered to this day. And so the deception inevitably came to light, right, when they didn't get paid and then they went to the queen and all this happened. But it was never, I don't believe she was executed. She was imprisoned for life, but the diamonds are gone. So it's just so bizarre. I just think the lengths that people will go through to get these just hard rocks out of the ground. And then the second story concerns the British crown jewels. This one is hilarious. So this is in 1671 and the crown jewels were stored in the Tower of London, right? It's like a fortress. There are many guards, multitude of guards. But an Irish man named Thomas Blood decided, like, I'm sure I can figure out a way to steal these. And so his plan involved costumes, fake titles, a whole fake daily routine, a fake life, and a fake family. So he hires a prostitute to be his fake wife, and they convince the keeper of the tower, that his name's Talbot Edwards, the keeper of the jewels, I believe was his title, that their fake nephew would definitely for sure marry his homely spinster daughter. I don't know why they thought this plan would work, but it did, which is what's amazing. So this guy's like, oh, great. And then he's like, well, you're basically family. And so they're like, we'd love to see the jewels. Basically family. And he's like, okay.
Oh my gosh.
So he lets them in with the fake nephew and two other guys. He lets them into the room totally unguarded. They knock him out. They tie him up and they take the jewels and the crowns and the scepters and they break them up. Like they bust them so they could fit them in their pants to walk out of the London Tower of London with them, which they do. And all I can imagine is what that sounded like clump, clump, clump. Jingling as you're walking along. They were caught immediately. There were guards like at the tower, like they're instantly caught. So this elaborate plan, which is hilarious, while they got their hands on the jewels, they didn't get very far. So they get thrown in jail and Thomas Blood says, I will not speak. I will not talk to anyone except the king. That's it. I'll only talk to the king. And they let him. They let him talk to the king, Charles II. And after that conversation, which is not recorded, no one documented it, Blood was pardoned. He received a pension of over £500 a year from the king and apparently a title and estate in Ireland. And no one knows the reason for the pardon. So obviously, lots of speculations.
He knew something.
Like something one of the theories deep. Was that like he was himself part of the plot, but I can't figure out what part he would play. Another was like that the king feared an uprising by Blood supporters. I don't think Blood had enough support. I think maybe he just found it so funny. And that's my theory, that he just found it so amusing. He's like, I've not laughed that hard in a decade. I will absolutely pardon you. So two stories about people stealing from royals, which I do enjoy. And then just the last thing I wanted to share with you was, this is recent 2019. And it's not from royals. It's from a jewelry store, which obviously I don't condone theft, but three men in London broke into a jewelry store in North London. And they, kind of knocked down the shopkeeper. They're kind of trying to hold her hostage, like keep her down on the floor, and they're stealing jewels. And it turns into a slapstick comedy. And if there's one thing you watch from our show notes, I beg of you, let it be this if you need a laugh. So the camera's in the back of this very narrow store and the woman gets away from them finally. And she runs into the back and she slaps the panic button on the way and she locks herself in the bathroom. And you're watching now them running back and forth. So they run for the door, but the panic button not only alerts the police, it locks the front door so they can't get out. So they're like shaking and kicking the door, and they can't get out until one of them thinks, oh, there's a release button behind the counter. There's no sound. It's just, you're watching them. It's like a Keystone Cops running back and forth. So they hit the button, they go running for the door. And the first guy goes out, but he doesn't hold the door with the other guys. So he gets out, the other two are in there. So they're running back and forth. They hit the button. And then the second guy goes out and he doesn't hold the door for the third guy. So the third guy runs to the back of the store where the button is, hits the button, and then runs to the door, but he can't get there fast enough. So he tries that like 3 or 4 times.
Oh my goodness.
He's kind of like older and out of shape, and he can't get out. And he's running back and forth. The cops are on their way. And then finally some dude comes by and he happens to push the door open, like a customer. He pushes the door open right as like the guy's released it. And then he holds it open for the robber to get away because he has no idea what's happening. And it is just comic, unintended comic genius. So like I said, please do watch that. One of those men was apprehended and spent time in prison. So there are my stories of funny jewelry heists.
That's awesome. I'm glad you did that, because it's so right, jewels, that's everything that comes to mind, and in movies and everything else. Much of what you just described, I kept thinking, gosh, somebody should script that, because every one of those, well, that last one's just funny, but like the first two stories are so involved, I could see that really being a film, you know.
Right. Well, the second one, someone, a comedy writer and I think director, I think his last name's Fenton. I'll link it to when this happened. It came up in the news just again last year because one of them had been, I guess, convicted. So it just came back in the news, and the news site also posted this video, and he just posted the video, and on top he wrote, I would definitely watch a heist movie where like the first hour and a half is planning and the last 12 minutes are just this.
Yes. Okay, so I, of course, started with a little bit of etymology just to set the stage for myself. And in this one, I thought there was something a little bit interesting, sort of. So this word for us comes through a French or an Anglo-Norman heritage. So there's several permutations of it, but it kind of breaks down to je, J-E-U, or a lot of things, right? Or the way we're spelling it now, J-E-W, et cetera, which is game in French. And then the suffix E-L, which is just an ending for a diminutive, right? So something smaller and often cuter or something, you know, well, that's used in French often in a lot of English. The use of that comes from the French EL or even EIL, or, you know, a lot of different endings for French words. So in a way that becomes a small game. However, which kind of doesn't make sense. But if you also look at some of the things that have blurred together from that time period, J-E-U is sometimes J-O-I-E, which is joie, which is joy. So if it becomes like a small joy or a small treasure, that starts to make more sense, right? I can't confirm this, but I also want to go back now and perhaps game, but what became game, might have been like a small treasured fun thing too. So the fact that you have joie and je so close together probably made sense at some point as well. So a small joy. And early uses of this around like 1100 appear to be first for valuable man-made things. So things that might have used jewels, but also could have been made of gold or silver or whatnot. That evolved a little bit later around 1300, to be something more specifically gemstones, right? So a jewel before that would have probably been something man-made that you might have used for adornment that wasn't necessarily a stone, like, you know. So yeah, by 1300, that changed a bit. Just, I didn't even keep it in my notes, but something else that I noticed was the word jewel also historically would be used to represent an emblem for like an organization. So like an old, like a symbol, like a coat of arms almost, or something that represented an older like social group of some kind, was often called the jewel of that group, which I thought was kind of cool. So that was kind of interesting for me. Excuse me. So starting from there, I kind of think of my arc through this as focusing on the very geological, like what are like a good kind of basic reminder of kind of what are gems again, and what are their types, just broadly. And then I'll move into a bit of how socially they've been viewed. I found some cool, more sociological takes on gems. But first, I did do some trivia, audience, for you to try to guess and to subject Allison to, of course. But the hope is here as I read these, audience, try to think what your answers would be, and Allison will give her thoughts as
all
well.
Right. I did great last time.
I think you did.
That's right. Probably not with me this time, but I'm ready.
All right. So trivia one, which two U.S. states led the nation in production of natural gemstones in 2021? Just guess two states. What you think they might be?
Arizona and Alaska.
You got Arizona.
All right. I was going to say Utah.
That's great. Arizona and Oregon.
Oregon. I would not have guessed that.
Nice. I would have done terribly at that. I love that you like nailed one of them. That's great. So for context, there are 13 of our states that produce 96% of annual natural gemstones. So we're concentrated, certainly. And for a little bit more context, so I gathered this by going to USGS, right? The US Geological Survey has a mineral and gemstone sort of yearly periodical publication that sort of sums up the industry a bit, which I filtered that through in our more in our trivia questions for this, but I kind of was fascinated to see that more manufacturing like finance context. So the total value of natural and synthetic gemstones, we'll get to synthetic shortly, output in the US for 2021 was $95 million. And that was a 25% increase over 2020. However, that was, as we all know, a year when COVID hit every industry, and gemstones was not spared for that. So it was an increase over 2020, but 2019 was a pretty significant spike. So in 2019, we were at 103 million. So getting up to 95, we didn't quite recover to where we were in 2019, but 2021 at least was a rebound and a bit of a recovery. And just to put it into context a little further, that 95 million breaks out into 10 million in natural production of gemstones. It's funny to say production, right? We'll get into like, but finding them, refining them, like, you know, all of that. And then 85 million, the rest of that is in synthetic. natural production of the US has been fairly consistent since 2017, right? That natural, it fluctuates only between 9.2 and 10 million, but the synthetic has been increasing quite a bit. So from 2017 to 2018, it was an 18% increase, and then it increased again 44% more between 2018 and 2019, up to that 105 million, right? So then COVID hits the industry and synthetic production declined by like 30%. And now we almost fully recovered, right? 28% increase into 2021. And of course, we don't have 2022 yet. So part of what I thought was interesting with that was, and I think I'm socially conditioned, we think of like cubic zirconia, we think of like, I think growing up, like there's this negative view of like cheap fake gems. But I think that is changing significantly for a lot of reasons, Allison, that you already described, blood, jewels, things like that, the negative impact on the environment as well. An article I found from 2020 BBC article about Meghan Markle, probably everyone knows who she is, but the Prince Harry's wife, describes how she really caught the attention of many when she wore a particular set of diamond drop earrings that were synthetically created. And the company was called, I believe it's pronounced Kimai. I might be butchering that, but it's K-I-M-A-I. I with an umlaut over it. And that company, yeah, is known to be creating synthetically. The two women that run this company came from family backgrounds of like jewel producers, and they took their own path to create synthetic jewels. So that's very cool. That's a company to check out. Probably put them in our notes.
Excellent.
And so that article goes on to say that many, many millennials now and Gen Z are rejecting natural gemstones for a lot of these reasons, right? Which are good. Negative environmental and the social impact that that has. So I think that certainly explains, because when I was looking at the data, I was like, gosh, why are we having like 18%, 44%, like massive increases year over year since 2017? And, yeah. You know, nothing comes right out to state that that is the cause, but I would think that must be part of the reason, right? Demand is going up for something other than the natural. So jump into just some basic geology for a moment. We know that these are precious gemstones, we say, like the precious, the rare stones. So a little bit of context for when we say rare. A popular phrase is you're one in a million, or something's one in a million as being rare. But you can think of diamonds, even diamonds that come from very rich areas of where diamonds are more prevalent. You can think of it as like, say you're in a store and you look at a diamond in a ring, that diamond is probably one part diamond to over 300 million parts ore. Wow. So whatever the, you know, just talking parts here, whatever the carat size is, whatever the weight or, you know, physical dimensions of that is, you're talking 300 million times that in just rock, other things that are not of value or as much, nearly as much value, right? It's an insane like amount of rarity, if you want to measure that. And these are usually coming from igneous rock pipes, they're called. That was the word I was looking for before. I forgot what I said. Veins. They're not veins.
Down the igneous rock pipe.
There you go. Pipes. Perfect. A little bit of context from another from that same article. These diamonds were generally created about 100 miles below the Earth's surface, and they formed between 1 billion and 3 billion years ago. Wow. Now, that is pretty fascinating, right? Like, part of me, as I was going through this week and researching, I thought, gosh, I think it's part of my big question, not to jump ahead, but it's like, why is it just the rarity of something and something that somebody else doesn't have? Is that so socially defined? That kind of bothers me. But I will say it's something like that where you picture how old it is. That I can see being kind of fascinating. But then again, this whole history, right? Everything you described, Allison, of like the reaction to something being of water or whatnot. Nobody knew, right? Our scientific age, we know they're 1 billion to 3 billion years ago, but that has not been human history. Right. We had no idea, right? Right? The world isn't that old, right? Well, religion. So then just a little bit more context. There are two types of gemstones. There are mineral gemstones, which are the classic ones that we think of, diamond, corundum. I actually learned this. Folks may have known this, but corundum is ruby and sapphire. I've only heard of them as ruby and sapphire, but corundum,
I've never heard that word ever.
Yeah. Corundum is the actual material. And if it's red, it's ruby. And if it's blue, it's sapphire, which is interesting. Same thing with beryl, B-E-R-Y-L. Beryl has a whole list of different classic stones, but the ones most folks would have heard of, emerald and aquamarine, are beryl. And you also have opal, garnet, and there's a list of others. In contrast to that, you have organic gemstones. So I think everyone's probably heard of amber and things from like Jurassic Park in the popular consciousness of that. We understand, you know, what that is, and it's usually sap or resins. It's biological stuff that over time and pressure became things like amber. You also have jet, and then of course pearl, being created in the ocean by living things. One little bit before we jump into another little trivia break here would just be a scale to keep aware of is the hardness scale that's most prominent in history for gemstones. It was created by a German, it's fun, interesting. I've seen him defined as both being German or Austrian, named Mohr. So Friedrich Mohr. not more, Moh, M-O-H. And so it's Moh's scale of hardness going from 1 to 10. And, you know, this, if anyone remembers earth science or geology, if it was the same, I grew up in New York State where we had probably a very particular sequence. But I remember taking different types of rocks and trying to scratch one against another and see which could dent or scratch the other one and sort of graph that out on what was probably a Mohs scale. I just don't remember it being called that. So talc being one, it's the softest, and then diamond being the hardest, which is why we use diamond tip drill bits and things like that. So I thought that was a little bit of the background. And then in part two, I'll go into how we've sort of bizarrely interpreted such a geological thing. Bizarre for me, but so trivia two. Everyone listening, see if I answer this along with Allison and see if your answer is right. So Allison, which gemstone accounts for the highest percentage of U.S. gemstone imports?
Imports. Sapphires.
It's diamonds.
Oh, see, that just seemed too easy.
Sorry, I know it was like a, it's like tricky because when I was writing, I was like, that does feel like obvious, but I would have done the same thing. I would have guessed because I was asking, probably would have gone with sapphires.
Right, because if you're asking.
It's my birthstone. And
for some, in all, oh, is it?
Mine
is
opal. September. Opal.
Yeah. I got opal. For some reason, in a lot of my research around different things, sapphires just kept coming up as being so popular, and I just hadn't realized. But apparently over the millennia, like sapphires were up there with diamonds, which is why I went for that.
Nice. Well, currently, 90% of our imports are diamonds, which I do think is such a bizarre shift, because I would have thought that, rubies, emeralds would be very popular. But apparently that's, I agree with you. In the past, maybe more so, but now diamonds just seems to rule. In fact, the metrics from the USGS were almost reported exclusively in diamond, and they would just explain it's almost all diamonds. There's either 5 or 10 or whatever percent that's not. But they wouldn't even really break out non-diamond metrics. It was all sort of pegged to the diamond as the main gemstone, which is interesting.
And I just personally find diamonds so boring. I just always have. I guess I want the shiny colored things.
Right. But I mean, it's probably because I grew up knowing that it was my birthstone, and I love blue to an obsessive degree. I love sapphire. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So a little bit more context for that. There's a huge difference in our production. So I mentioned before, a huge difference in U.S. production versus our importation. So I just mentioned, diamonds are our main import. And this may not perhaps be surprising. I know that I think we as Americans put a lot of pressure on ourselves to be competitive in other U.S. markets, and we don't want to just be consumers. Well, this is not an example of us necessarily generating as much as we're consuming. It's a huge difference. So I mentioned before in 2021, our combined production, that's combined natural and synthetic, is 95 million. However, in 2021, the U.S. imported $24 billion of gemstones, 90% of which was diamond. So stated otherwise, we import 252 times the value of the gemstones that we produce.
Wow.
Which is mind-blowing to me. Crazy, right? Anyway, and so that does put us as the top. The U.S. leads the world in demand and the value of consumption of gemstones. I don't know how I feel about that. It makes sense to me, but I also feel like, gosh, we have mines. I don't know that we're quite on par with some other nations. I'll get to that in our last trivia question coming up. But I feel like, I don't know. Am I alone there, Allison? It feels like, gosh, that disparity. Why don't we start producing a little bit more of this?
Right. Well, hopefully with synthetics, we will. That's the only way to go, right?
Because but I guess we're starting, right? I mean, if we've gone up 44%, maybe that will continue to increase and the future of synthetic might grow. Just a reminder, I said it before, but it's new information. I wouldn't expect anyone to remember. But that natural, at least since 2017, has stayed flat, about 9.5 million. But the synthetic has been growing. So we'll see. Okay. So moving slightly differently to like a social aspect, we're going to talk a little bit about a medieval views on gemstones. I found this great paper that sort of laid out this, the how it was perceived and viewed. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised, unfortunately, right? I've brought up so many times that I would rather try to reject this, like, let's make up otherworldly rules rather than just like have an empirical, logical approach to things. Well, we didn't, right? So one quote here, a direct quote is, for medieval and Renaissance viewers of religious manuscripts, as well as wearers of jewelry, precious stones were not only this beautiful thing, but worn correctly, which is interesting, worn correctly, gems were thought to harness virtues or powers to protect the owners from harm. Now, it's funny, when I read that, I thought, that's crazy. But then again, right away, I think of, it's kind of rebounding right now in popular culture with crystals.
Yeah,
and
sure.
These, right, at least like, it's not quite homeopathic, but I guess it kind of falls under there. Like this like alternative medicine home vibe thing, which drives me a bit insane. Because as I work, audience, you may recall, I work in pharmaceuticals. I'm very like clinical trial, evidence oriented. And although I respect the meditative effect of things, like there is a grounding nature that I really respect for certain things, but I just have never, I don't ever want that confused with like actual efficacy of something medically, right? Whatever is soothing, whether it be a ball of cotton in your pocket or a smooth stone or a candle, not in your pocket, but like using a candle or something like that, that's all fine, right? It's how you're reacting to it. But to say point blank, as they did in this time period, that a certain stone would defend you from
right.
demons or it would heal you physically, it's a little much. Another quote here from a different paper. I post in the notes. One was a paper that I found online. The other was a book written in 1922 by, I think it's pronounced Isidore, or Isidore, but Isidore Kosminski. And it's a whole book about, and it's like 400 pages, I think, long. It's a whole book of jewel legends and background and histories of certain diamonds. And I think it's kind of fascinating. And it really goes into detail on what each of these stones was like meant to do or meant to be. And so if anyone wants to, you know, go deeper into this, you can look that up. I found it on the Gutenberg project for free online. So here's a little, some background from that. The ancient masters held that influences exerted by the heavenly bodies entered into these harmonious relations with various terrestrial substances. So that's where you get like where they've got powered up basically by the otherworldly, right? That these stones, these precious gems captured these essences. So it's almost like the stone itself wasn't doing it. They were fueled. They were charged by something magical and deities, yeah, and things like that. Goes into a little bit of background that the great physician Galen used sapphire for, quote, expelling the hot humors of the body, which unfavorable health condition is included in the astrological philosophy of the evils of the sign Aquarius. So let me say that again. Basically, they'd be,
that's
like Aquarius people. Those that have the sign Aquarius have a lot of unhealthy astrological physiology. They are hot humored and all this other stuff. So there was this idea that Aquarius needed to use sapphires to sort of heal them of their inherent Aquariusness and hot humor. And they held up Leo as the opposite side. I think anybody who's into astrology will know this probably. But Leo is like this opposite pure sign versus Aquarius, apparently. Probably a lot of listeners right now freaking out at what I just said.
I know, but you might get some hate now.
That's what I read. And so they go even farther. I looked specifically at sapphire just because, as we mentioned, I like it and so on. The sign also has a particular rule over eyesight. So here's something that drives me crazy, right? It goes from like this meditative positive thing to like specific medicinal uses that they were trying to use. So imagine, you know, it's not quite leaching, but it's similar. It's worse. Here's an example here. Ancient writers say that he who gazes into a sapphire will charm away any threatened eye injuries that might be happening to them. So they would just gaze into the jewel and like their eyes would get healthier. I learned about a bishop named Marbod in French, Marbod, or Marbodus, also referred to as Marbodus, who was a bishop in Rennes, in France, from about 1035 to 1123, and wrote a book called De Lapidibus, which is on gemstones. I guess lapidibus must be gemstones. And it was a book about the medicinal, therapeutic, and magical properties of 60 different jewels. So here you go, somebody who is like high renowned in a high position in religion, writing basically a medical textbook about these magic gems. It blows my mind. And specifically, I love this one. He recommends that sapphires dissolved in milk, excuse me, what? Not possible. Dissolved in milk takes the sting from dimmed eyes, or for removing foreign bodies from the eyes, like specks of dust and sand, it was recommended to take the sapphire, hold it there with a closed eyelid, and gently draw it slowly across.
Okay, from the nose that sounds absolutely damaging.
Right, damaging. Fascinating. The reference goes into a very classical vein. A vein of thinking at the time was to cure something, you would take a bit of the dismay, the problem. Would help unlock the issue. Does that make sense? So you would use whatever was ailing you, you kind of use that to fight it,
right?
Rather than an opposite or, you know, something that would probably make sense. So here you are using a bit of stone because you have stone in your eye. And so, yeah, to your point, let's just scrape it across the eye. I've had corneal abrasions. They're not fun. And to do it at a time period where you didn't have any anesthetic or anything else. I just can't even imagine the wild agony of somebody going
through that. The Middle Ages were a rough time.
Good times. Okay. So this connection to religion, not just right in this bishop, but also apparently there's a ton of jewel imagery, not actual jewels, although potentially in some ways, but drawings, representations of jewels that flood medieval liturgical texts. So any books and things used in religious services, that's what we mean by liturgical manuscripts. And so the representation of these precious stones is really, it's everywhere. And part of the thinking of that, which I never knew, was that that gems were often believed in the time to have originated from four rivers in paradise. So these rivers were in the Garden of Eden, basically, and flowed out through these rivers as, you know, paradise was lost and the garden was sealed off from humankind. But that's where gemstones came from.
But they gave us the gems as a consolation prize?
Or they like flowed out. I don't know if I can find the reference. I'll try to post it. But there was a painting where you see this angel with this wall of fire having guarded off, like walled off with like a sword and fire, saying Eden's closed. But apparently you see in the corner of like the river some gemstones of like
sneaking
out. We like to make shit up. Okay, so then in Victorian times, just to sort of bring this to a close and finish with our last trivia little question. Victorian times took a bit of that religious thinking. I think because it was so seen that way in medieval times, of course, sort of continued to a degree. I don't think it was as directly religious, but probably not a surprise. In religious times, apparently everything in art or how you presented yourself had a very particular story. And this for me is probably a follow-up rabbit hole that would be kind of interesting to go down. Apparently in a lot of the paintings that we're probably used to seeing from the time period, things like a glove folded on a mantle had very particular meaning, or how you decorated a particular part of room in your house, things that were in the room had very, very specific meanings, apparently. I'm not familiar with what they are, but just the fact that that, you know, certain types of flowers in a certain place meant right. something very specific. So you can imagine faux pas were abounding if you did something like that would be shocking, and which I think makes sense to us. At least it does to me. When you think of Victorian times, you think of such a strict, rigid policy about everything. Makes sense.
Right. So like nations go to war because somebody put yellow begonias in the dining room.
Exactly. Like if somebody full out faints because that's how they're viewed. The quote here is, it should come as no surprise then that Jules spoke volumes about a particular person's station in life as well, or what they were going through. So that evolved to be, this article mentions, statement jewelry. Like we're not devoid of that now. Things have changed. They get a little bit into how current really high end jewelry may have bucked the trend of clarity to a degree. We always think gems have to be super clear, or that is still there. But apparently the very high end jewelers are creating things that almost have marbling effect or even iridescent qualities. There's something a bit more unique, apparently, is where they're going right now, which when you think about it, is still just uniqueness, right? Clarity was probably there because it was unique, but now you have enough clear gems in circulation, you want something that's a little different.
Right.
I just think that's interesting. We can kind of end here with our last trivia question. Okay. There are four countries from whom the U.S. gets 88% of its diamond imports. Four countries. Can you guess maybe one or a couple of them if you throw out some things?
Brazil, India, and South Africa.
You named two, India and South Africa. Okay. Brazil is not there. But yeah, India is in the lead at 41% of our imports. Israel is 31%. And I feel like I need to look into that because I would not picture a small nation.
I believe there are a lot of diamond brokers though in Israel. So I wonder if they pass through instead of
pass through.
There.
I got it.
I don't know. But
yeah, maybe that's it. I was just like, what? Israel, Belgium. Oh, sorry. So India's 41%, Israel's 31%. Belgium is 12 and South Africa is 4. Nice job. I would completely been guessing.
Well, I had to be South Africa with things, and then I'd read about India being the for so many years, and then Brazil I read about. So honestly,
I know that's good. That's good.
Plucking from research.
A little bit more context. I looked at the countries. There's a list of countries in that USGS, annual update, and 97%. Of annual diamond mine production comes from seven countries, which is very concentrated. Namibia, Congo, or Kinshasa, South Africa, Angola, Botswana, Canada, which I don't know why that was a surprise to me, but it is. I mean, it shouldn't be. It's a massive amount of land. And Russia. Russia leads by quite a margin with 29% of global mine production. They are pumping out 18 million carats of gem quality diamond, right? So there's, I don't think I mentioned that, but you may know that, Allison, from your research, but audience, there are different quality and a gem diamond quality, like the highest quality that you could really sell for jewelry or like whatnot. There's probably other quote unquote dirtier, not as pure, that might be used more for like drilling or, more industrial uses than precious stones. So thankfully though, we don't appear to take any significant amount. Like it might've been lumped in the data that I saw, India, Israel, Belgium, South Africa, maybe Russia's in that lumped together small amount of 10 to 12%. I hope not, but I would be shocked now in particular because of the war crimes and the war against Ukraine. Like I would assume that part of our banning in so many areas would include their diamond trade, which I didn't realize that they're such a leader in.
Yeah, it would be interesting. It might be hard to determine, though, just like the provenance can get pretty muddy of gems. And so they probably have ways to get them in the market through the brokers.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. To your point, because I was so surprised, Israel is nowhere listed on this list. How are we getting that? But to your point, maybe it's a second exchange. I'd love to see to somehow track it.
Same thing for the, did you say Belgium or the Netherlands?
Belgium. 12%.
I think there's like a big diamond exchange there as well. So I think that's why they're on the list.
That makes sense. Yeah. And then where I left digging off was more about this move towards synthetic gemstones. I think that hooked me as an interesting, future of the account of that market to reject the negative impact of the natural, but then also to look at how that process can become a bit more carbon neutral. The BBC article that I mentioned said, yes, there are so many negatives to the natural in terms of environment. To your point, right? I saw pictures online of these massive mines that you can see from outer space, right? It's just so much dirt being shifted and moved, as I mentioned, right? One part diamond to like 300 to 400 million parts like of ore. It's a crazy amount of disruption to the environment, which led to sort of acidic issues with drainage to drinking water, to surrounding villages and areas wherever these mining operations are happening, like just negative. However, there was apparently a balancing story of synthetic isn't great from a carbon perspective either. I do think it's probably outweighed. I'm not sure of this, but my gut is it's outweighed by all the other negatives we just listed for natural, that it's probably better net. But my curiosity is, as that synthetic market grows, how can that improve and be more neutral over time? That's my research for this week.
That was so interesting. I especially loved hearing all the kind of wackery of the Middle Ages.
So crazy. Yeah, right?
What you're doing with them.
Yeah, which makes me realize, the more I read about it, the more I thought, geez, duh, I should have assumed. We seem to do that with everything, frankly. But like in painting, colors of certain things at the time, right? Like it wasn't just... it wasn't, just gemstones. It was in the arts in so many ways. Like in some ways, I really do feel like we think of everything we can do in our modern lives. But back then, there weren't all of these distractions. Things were, these were big deals. When you were presenting yourself as a human being in a public space in the past, it was kind of entertainment to other people. You know what I mean? Like it was a much more focus. Does that make sense? Than now. We didn't have massive sports things to distract the masses, or movies to sit down. We didn't have Netflix. We didn't, so the physicality of things I could see being so much more provocative if something was different, or whatnot.
Right. Although I think we probably just do it in different ways now.
Yeah, that's true.
That could be a whole follow-up.
Perhaps. Big questions, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, what were you going to say though?
I was going to say that's probably a good, segue into big questions are.
So you segued this perfectly. I'm glad the order went the way it did today, because my big question involves synthetic gemstones. So now I don't have to talk about them before I ask my big question, but you also, interestingly, much earlier in your rabbit hole, you kind of stated my big question. So for one, I'll just kind of state it and, get your follow-up thoughts. But, as Mark mentioned, synthetic gemstones, they're the same chemical makeup as the natural ones. In most, they have better clarity, which Mark was just talking. I didn't know about how actually, maybe less perfect clarity is now a thing that people are looking for. But, this idea used to be all about clarity. These synthetics are exact same chemically. They have better clarity. They have fewer flaws and they're less expensive. And there's certainly, I don't know if I can say no exploitation, but less exploitation in their manufacture. But people still want the real thing, right? And so I think this points to human greed and the thirst for power in more than shiny things make me think of water. And I'm driven by this like urge I don't even recognize consciously, because then we would want the synthetics because they're shinier and they're clearer. And so greed kind of, I was thinking, well, does that mean greed trumps evolutionary psychology? I was thinking, yep, it does, because we're greedy humans. And then I thought, but wait, it doesn't, because is our desire to own something? And Mark, you basically said this. So is our desire to own something rare also just our monkey brains trying to be king of the castle? Like it is in fact evolutionary psychology. It's just that power trumps like water. So that's kind of where I went with it. And then my second question was just around, with all the outcry for different royal families to return gemstones that they got in nefarious ways to countries, what is the right answer there? I certainly don't think personally the right answer is the royals keep them. But if they're just handed back to other rulers, it seems to me maybe because those gems probably did come from exploited workers, even if it was the 13th century, for instance. So maybe, you know, maybe are there other options? Like, is it maybe better to make sure that all of them are housed in museums and put in like a trust sort of thing, where no one in the future, and except with an like a violent overthrow, of course, could get to them, and they go to museums where everyone can view them. So those are my two questions. But the first one you kind of already asked.
No, I love that. Yeah, and we can discuss your second one, but maybe I'll. I think part of what I mentioned before became the seed for my big question. So this is going to sound very repetitive, but I love that we're all thinking the same thing. Yeah, my first big question. I mean, literally, this is just a paraphrase. I said here, is it related to our survival instincts somehow as a species to value the rare, to desire something that few others may have? Why do we see something with a higher frequency of availability as being lower value? Right? Like taking economics out of it, because you could think of supply and demand, and of course, yeah, right. That's a little bit different, but like,
because that's what I was going to say. Is it because it becomes currency? That's why.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But and part of me doesn't want to reject it. Like, well, I'll get there in a second, maybe. So part of that is, you know, why do we get this joy or thrill from owning something that few others have? Right. That's where it comes down to. When I would have loved it to be a part of our species, if instinctually, what I feel like we try to learn to do, like through meditation or being, you know, mindful, everything that right now I think we're learning, and I don't want to just say popular culture like it's going to be here and gone tomorrow. I think it will stick around. We're trying to learn to really value anything, right? Human interaction, sunlight, where you are and what you have. And wouldn't it have been interesting if, as a species, that those types of interactions were valued as jewels? Yes. Much more so.
Much better world.
You know what I mean? Than, oh, this shiny thing that no one else has. I'm gonna keep it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a super similar question.
I wish we could really have an answer to it.
Yeah, but I think maybe we talked about that one. To respond to your other big question just briefly. Yeah, like this return of things. I don't have an answer. I don't think we'll just come up with one. I get torn when it's this massive reset, because at this point in history, you drew a distinction between what the royal family has and owns versus what is in museums. But even the British Museum comes under massive fire to return everything that they have.
Like the Elgin marbles and right.
So it's almost two different things, but let me like just briefly on the museum thing. I feel like every nation, because things moved around so much, at least I think, that would be a massive reset of everything. So to a degree, I feel like that's not potentially worth it, unless there are very glaring examples that would set a very nice harmony between nations if something was returned. But then if it becomes this massive reset where everything has to go back, that feels too much and like too much to untangle.
But yeah, I do think it's a lot to untangle, and that it's complicated and convoluted, but I do still think it's important to try. But what makes it even more convoluted is you get to other issues. So instead of just rightful ownership, you get to what are those going to be used for? That's why I was saying, should these be in a trust somehow? Also you get down to, I just completely lost my train. The safety of artifacts in some cases.
Oh yeah.
So when, you know, think about Al-Qaeda destroying those ancient statues. And so in some cases, should things not go back for that reason, you know, if we only go by ownership, you know, people could say that's the right way to do it, but then you have to think about these other things, or will they go back and fund ethnic cleansing, war crimes, et cetera. So it does get very tricky.
It does, because it's a rabbit hole-ish in itself, but it becomes a bit about an individual sovereignty of a nation versus what as humanity around the globe deserves. Because say these treasures, to your point, go back to a particular nation that is unstable at the time, politically, socially, and they get destroyed. You're robbing the world of that history and learning through that object what that represents for everyone. But it is that nation's
right
thing.
Exactly.
So it becomes like, which do you value more, community versus the individual in a way, or the nation versus an international community? It's tricky. But I would say the other side of things, for like a particular family, what you mentioned, kind of defrauding, well, not quite defrauding, but well, maybe. I'm sure a lawyer would have a field day on, there's a, what did you say, a 10-year-old?
10-year-old boy.
10-year-old. Like, mm-hmm. Now, what is the justification that was a legitimate thing? Although I guess a true lawyer would say that was the head of state and it signed and that at the time period, yada, 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 it holds. But again, come on. It's not like they're about to sell it. Like, it would mean so much. It would be such a gesture if that was returned.
Mark's like, and to close my argument, come on.
Come on.
Right? Rest my case.
That's why I'm not a lawyer, right? I just look at the jury and be like, come on. It's ridiculous. Anyway, so did I have one other? I love your, related to that instinctualness, right? Not just the rarity. This kind of gets to it. My question after this, is it just about having something that's rare? I did say, or is it truly that in a world that for so long was made of rock and mud and wood and clay, something that has this very gorgeous, distinct quality of light and smoothness and everything else became truly dazzling. It may not only be about having something that someone else doesn't have, but truly having the object itself. And the more that you mention the research done on what that's doing psychologically to us in terms of reminding us of water or something, that's fascinating. Because, you know, then it's not just greedy. I want it because someone else doesn't have it, but somewhere instinctually it's.
Right. I mean, I do hope that's partly in there and it's not just greed, but I honestly don't know, given humanity's history. As usual, I think our big questions, we don't have the answers, but the point is for, to get us thinking about them.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Fantastic. It was a cool week.
It was.
So I guess we want to revisit before I give us our new word.
Absolutely. I think you said you had rated it. I have to actually go back. You'd rated Jewel an 8 and I'd rated it a 7.
Yes.
I'm going to bump it up. Actually, I'm going to bump it up to an 8. I'm going to bump it up to an 8. And the reason is I honestly enjoyed this research a lot. There were multiple directions to go in, as always. And all of them were really interesting to me. And like, there was none of them that I thought, oh, this doesn't work at all. And I do think when you start thinking about evolutionary psychology and that sort of thing, it becomes really, really interesting. I also enjoyed the really funny stories. I read many other funny stories that I didn't share as well, of ridiculous jewel heists. So I think after this, I'm going to go watch Lupin, which I never finished watching on Netflix, which is.
Oh, I have that in my queue too.
Jewel Thief. Yeah. I saw a couple episodes and it was quite good. So yeah, I'm going to go to an 8 and you were at an 8. So what do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it at an 8. I was interested to read up on it and I stayed interested. I don't think it wowed me or, you know, I was kind of interested with, the rise of the synthetic and what that will mean. it wasn't a surprise for me to find, and I could have become more negative on it, right? To find something that was like a religious sort of mythology, completely irrational, like rules come up for no reason. Like that bothers me as like a human thing that we do. Like, why can't we just look at what's around us and prove it before we start to say, oh yeah, it's magical. Gaze into the sapphire so you don't go blind. What? Come on. It's my new thing. I'll be my t-shirt. Come on, humans. so yeah, I'll keep it at an 8.
Excellent. All right. So this was a pretty good one for us then in terms of how much we enjoyed it. So I think it's your week to generate the word for next week.
Is. All right. Let me pop over here to our generator. The generator, not our generator. And 3, 2, 1. Writing.
Writing. Oh, wait, we said no gerunds.
Oh, we sure did. That's right. It's a good catch. All right. Anyone who's new or doesn't remember, one of our early words was shopping, and we hated it. We liked the week in general, but gerunds threw us for a loop.
Yeah.
So let me redo this. 3, 2, 1. Tongue.
I like it. Tongue. I had to say it.
12. I'm just kidding. I love this one.
Okay. Tongue. I'm definitely going high with this. I'm going to go with a 9.
I love it. I'm adding it to our little spreadsheet. 9 for Allison. I'm going to stick with an 8.
All right. Giving yourself some room to work with there for the adjust. Tongue but I'm going all
I don't know
in.
What that means. Got it. Tongue room. That's not even an expression. I mean, already making it.
Yeah, maybe that'll be what you'll make up something to teach us about next week. All right.
Excellent. Well, thank you everybody for listening to this episode 8. Jewel, and as we just talked about, we will be discussing tongue next time. So if you enjoyed the show, just a reminder, please follow and subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on. We would also love it if you rated us. That just helps us build our audience, get more folks listening. And you can also, of course, find us. We would encourage you to find us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter primarily, at Renowned Podcast. Please follow, share our posts, say hi, DM us. It's fine. Slip into our DMs. Totally, totally understandable. We would love to hear from you, any feedback, whatnot, as we continue to build the show and build the audience. We also have the website, renownedpodcast.com. There you can listen to the show, find platforms that you might not be aware of that distribute the show. And you can also read in our blog a lot of the notes that are in our show notes, but also some more detailed works cited and things like that that we post on the website and nowhere else. Thank you very, very much. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.